As a proud parent of two public school students, Gus Walls, who is a sixth grader at Dakota Meadows Middle School in Mankato, and Hope Walls, who's a senior at Mankato West, the school where I taught for many, many years. I am a public school teacher, as many of you know. I think with Gary Amoroso and his group there, I am the son of a superintendent of schools and grew up in that, in a small rural community. I decided, as many did when you're young, that I wasn't going to follow in my parents' footsteps, and that changed very quickly when I realized teaching was in my blood. I got my teaching degree by using the GI Bill, joined the military when I was 17, got my first teaching job out in Pine Ridge. I taught at Wolf Creek Elementary in a Bureau of Indian Education school, and then was part of the first group of American high school teachers allowed to teach in Chinese high schools in the 1980s, and spent 2 years in Fosun and Guangdong. They taught me Mandarin and dropped me into a Cantonese-speaking area, so it was like having fluent German and French, so I... into it. I came back to Nebraska, took a teaching job in a small school district on the Wyoming border, where I had a room that was divided with a temporary divider because we didn't have enough room, and got to know, because of my loud geography lessons, a wonderful young English teacher from Minneota, Minnesota, right next door, who ended up being my best friend and my wife, Gwen, of 24 years, who is an English teacher and the assessment coordinator in District 77 down in Mankato. We got the opportunity when we looked around. Where did we want to, as young professionals, where did we want to teach? Where did we want to raise our children? And that answer was very simple: Minnesota, a place that valued education, a place that valued teachers, a place that lifted up the profession and brought joy to that. And that time in Mankato West shaped me, and it shaped my future. I wouldn't imagine myself and did not plan my life to be in elected office, but I think my life prepared me well. My running mate, Peggy Flanagan, a early childhood educator, a former executive director of the Children's Defense Fund, suburban legislator from St. Louis Park, and a proud daughter of the White Earth Nation of Ojibwe. When we found this together, our vision for Minnesota, and it's not just a campaign theme, it's a way to see the world, was a one Minnesota. And it was predicated on some very simple things. One is that every single person in this state, every single child, should have the opportunity to succeed, white, black, brown, or indigenous. And that we were both absolutely convinced, and both of us from life experiences, that that was all predicated, and life's trajectory started with that education. It started with that public school. And what we also is that children do not come in pieces. When a child comes to school after sleeping in a car, it's incredibly difficult for them to learn geography. If they've got a toothache, it's incredibly difficult for them to learn geography. And so as a state of Minnesota and our vision for a place that has innovated, whether it be in agriculture or in medicine, a place that carved a life out of a harsh northern climate, a place that has a standard of living second to none because invested in our people. And that means coming back to the basics of public education and the things that we can do together with you. Our belief is that the experts in this room and those administrators in those buildings and teachers in those classrooms are the people who are going to make that impact and know best. And I know, as a teacher, to joy back into teaching, that's where the student achievement starts to make the difference. And for each and every one of you, I asked early on, and I trade you out with that. I've got a pretty loud voice on my own. Thank you. But I got asked early, and someone said, you've got a really bold agenda for Minnesota. And I said, yes, because Minnesotans are bold. And then they said, well, what's your bold ideas for education? I said, fully fund it to start out with, because it starts out with some of those things. And so I see the job of governor to help lay out the message. It's not to come to you with 10-point plans. It's not to understand that each and every one of these districts are different. It's certainly to try and find a way that we are stronger together in this state, and this nonsense that there is a metro and there is a greater Minnesota and that we do not share the common values and the common bonds is something that we decided early on. When people asked and they said they were wondering what kind of campaign I was running, they said, is it an endorsing campaign? Is it a primary campaign? It is a general election campaign? It was a governing campaign to build a coalition afterwards so that we have the political will to do the things that we need to get done. And we make sure that we're doing the legislative fixes that make a difference. And we make sure we're putting those decision makings together, that the people most impacted by the decisions we make need to have a seat at the table. And I can tell you this, I just spoke with several of you, and I've been involved in many of that. When we congratulate one another for passing referendums and operating referendums and building referendums, my job is to make sure you never have to do that again, because we fully fund things that they need to get done, that we make sure that happens. And that's going to take the will of the public to get there, and they're on your side. They're there with you. These are hard decisions, and I'm telling you, this issue about, when I keep get asking, and it is the right question for taxpayers, facts, how much it's going to cost. We have a responsibility to have a conversation in this state. What is our goal for our state in terms of that workforce and that education? And so when we hear of things, when it's equity and education and how early we start with that, when I hear people talk about it, and we know, and we're honest, and we bring this forward, that our opportunity gap or achievement gap for children of color. We need to quit talking about it that way. That's an opportunity and achievement gap for all of Minnesota. And what we know in the next 25 years, 70% of our workforce is going to come from communities of color. It's in everybody's best interest, morally and economically, that we give you the tools necessary and use the best practices and the research to close that opportunity gap and have the honest conversation of what it takes to attract and retain teachers who are culturally competent, who stand in front of those students and look like those students to be able to deliver what they need to deliver. Those are the conversations at the end. And I watched an interesting discussion the other day when we were talking about, and I had visited Stillwater Prison, and many of you know this continuum of cross from pipeline of school to incarceration and to corrections, and standing out there, and we had a corrections officer who was killed. And it seems like there was great political unity around that we need to have more corrections officers, which I think we came to that. And then someone made the suggestion, how are you going to pay for that? And they said, well, we can cut it from the social services on the front end. We can look at the education budget. You will never pay for corrections if you're not funding education, if you're not doing the front end, if you're not putting the money in that breaks that chain. And that's what the governor's job is to do, to build the political will to tackle these tough questions, to work hand in hand with the folks at the point of attack where you are on tackling these problems. And then I have to tell you, this is the 20-year... I'm a career public school teacher, and I did it because of the joy that was in that classroom. And I see my job, should I be given the privilege to be the governor of Minnesota, one of the top priorities is to make sure that every single day I am lifting up those classroom teachers, that I am bringing the joy back to that job, that we are having honest conversations, and I think you'll get into some of the specific questions about making sure that we're reducing the paperwork burden, we're reducing the added unfunded mandates that come, and that this idea that we can't find those solutions in those classrooms, in those buildings, in those school districts. So I thank you for the work you do. I'm honored to be here with you, and certainly welcome any questions.
Thank you, Congressman. So the first question is, since 2003, the basic education funding formula has lost considerable ground to inflation. In fact, the formula would be $618 per pupil higher today if it had simply kept pace with inflation. Do you support indexing the formula allowance to inflation?
Yes, and my job, again, is to go out and talk to the public about why this. I'm a couple things in Congress when I first came back, and I went right from the high school classroom, social studies classroom, geography classroom to Congress, and I came back and somebody after that first term said, what did you learn? And I said, well, I learned to say, never say it can't get worse. That's the one thing I learned to say. And then I ran into a lot of people who know the price of everything and the value of nothing. And this issue of having not an honest conversation about index to inflation, it is absolutely intellectually disingenuous and dishonest not to say that things go up every year and to index it for it. It gives you no certainty in your budgeting. And again, by being honest about budgeting and by saying and answering this question, that bought me a billboard downtown that shows you how much money that I'm going to run up or whatever. That's the pace and that's the space where the job of the governor and the job of elected officials is to go to the taxpayers and rightfully so make the case of where we're spending their money. So our One Minnesota 21st Century Education Plan makes it very clear. I will demand and hold firm on that any budgeting that we do hold inflationary costs as part of that, and that those are continuous to give you that certainty. And it's the best way to do it. We can have the conversation where that money's being spent. That's fine. But to cut that in the front end is disingenuous. And then to get to the fact that we are going to, and I hope we get the questions on this, of equity among school districts, the idea of where your zip code is impacting the decisions you're going to make. One of the foundational principles of Minnesota's great growth and our economic growth was predicated on that equal funding in the early 1970s that we need to start looking for ways to adjust for that heavy burden on property tax. And obviously bipartisanly, there's an admission that this is true when we made some corrections for agricultural lands, but that's not going far enough, and that's what we intend to do.
Well, thank you very much. You've answered actually question number three.
Okay.
And I'm just going to give you that just so that I can knock it off my list.
Yes.
Do you support increasing operating referendum equalization to address these inequalities? And when I say these, I would just be restating what you just actually
yes,
said.
Yes, and as I said, that's exactly right. And again, this is, again, the job to go out and talk to the public. All of these discussions we're having when it comes down to funding, it's all predicated on having that conversation about what are the outcomes they expect, what are the needs, what's it cost to get there, and monitoring to get there. But then to make the case, and I would say it again, we get this right. Every single thing we do is about improving student achievement and improving their capacity to be able to contribute into the economy. So a disingenuous front-end cost of simply raising those levies or equalizing those levies doesn't take everything else into consideration in terms of the economic impact we're going to get to it. Lower correction costs, lower social services costs. We've not done a good enough job of making that case. And I understand, and I think we'll come back to it, this children not coming in pieces. You'll do everything you can, but let's be very, very clear. If that child comes to school after sleeping in a car, if that child comes to school after witnessing trauma, if that child comes to school with any other numerous things, that is a cost that is being absorbed by the school district that is society's cost that all of us share in. And doing a better job of articulating that lets the taxpayers know. And I am, again, interested to hear from all of you, but become a real believer in our models that differ from area to area and give you the flexibility to do that. But when I've seen full-service community schools operating in that mode and bringing those resources to bear, that takes the burden off of the school board members who are here to be fixing societal issues that are far removed from what happens when they walk through that schoolhouse door. So,
Thank you.
That answer number five, two, or something?
Close.
All right.
In the current year, school districts will be forced to spend almost $700 million of funds meant for regular classroom instruction on mandated special education programs. Will you support significantly increasing special education funding to reduce the cross-subsidy?
Yes, and this is the most challenging one, and in full disclosure, I know Gary and Cindy well from Mankato, so I was going to use the John Klaber, our special ed director down there, has been on, and we've talked about this since I was in the classroom, and we've seen it. But being very clear, and I know this room knows it, and the basic decency of Minnesota, special education is a civil right, and we need to deliver it. But we also understand that the federal government, and all of us agree that we should do it, but laid down a pretty intense series of mandates that were never funded to what needed to be met. The closest we came was during the Recovery Act of 2009 when we plussed that up. And many of you, school board members and superintendents, probably felt the difference just when we finally reached up to about 27% of the federal government's responsibility. That had a massive increase. And I have feared this for years of pitting the classroom, if you will, against the special ed need of creating where parents mean well but are wondering why their students are losing some things, why we're changing this to do the special ed piece of this. We've got to figure out first and foremost, and this is going to include the funding thing, and that clock downtown is going to run again, I guess. But also I think there's things we can do in here that make sure that every child is, and we are living up to that civil right that we have the right to deliver them, the legal right. But there's got to be some regulatory humility in there to be able to release some of that burden of the paperwork, some of the things that happen. And I say that not because we don't want to do it, but someone told me, and I'm very careful about doing this, I left the classroom 12 years ago, and my wife reminds me that is a lifetime. And it has changed dramatically in the 12 years since you left the classroom. But at that last time I left, in my rotation of five classes, I had 37 IEPs. But at also times, I had three paras in a classroom in one class in my seventh hour geography to help assist with that. And they were fundamental in helping make sure that I was following the IEP, I was following up on what needed to be done. That, if that would not have been there, it would have been a situation where, as a teacher, the choice would have been to put other things off or to fulfill that. So, yes, my commitment's to getting this right. It's to reigniting this a conversation amongst Minnesotans. It's trying to not pit us against our students that all of us know we want to deliver to our special needs students. But it is increasingly evident to me that we cannot go on in this direction, still take care of our needs with those students and make the budget work for the classrooms. That's going to have to be addressed. It is a crisis situation. Now, you've been talking about it for a decade and you've continued to make it work the best you can, but at some point we'll get beyond that red line. It'll be very, very difficult.
Thank you. Do you support vouchers, expanded tax credits, or other taxpayer subsidies for non-public schools? If yes, should non-public schools that receive taxpayer funding be required to comply with state mandates, be held accountable for how taxpayer dollars are spent, and be open to all students?
No, I don't support vouchers, and I have much to say on that other part, but I'll leave it at that. Just be very clear, as your governor, I've made it clear, I don't support it. I support public schools. I will not weaken the budgets that are there. If there's parents choose to go, then they can go, but it's not going to be with vouchers, who then, many of us know that cost subsidy is coming back from those schools back to you again, too, is what ends up having to be taken care of. So, no.
Thank you. Under current law, an operating referendum is limited to a maximum of 10 years. Renewal of an existing operating referendum must be approved by the voters, even if it is at the same level as previously approved. Do you support allowing locally elected school boards to renew an existing operating referendum by a majority vote of the school board?
Yes, I do. And those school board members in here, I do want to thank you so much for the work. When I first ran for Congress, someone asked me, they said, you never run for anything before. Why don't you run for school board or city council? And I said, are you insane? You know how hard those jobs are? And they know where you live. People know where you live. Absolutely, but I'm going to take this a step further, and I know this is one that's a big step, and I'm not when people think that I'm naive or Pollyannish, I remind them I supervised the high school lunchroom for 20 years. I am not naive, but I'm frustrated by the way we treat school boards. Did you know of all the taxing authorities? I think there's 37 or whatever in Minnesota. The mosquito control board can do taxation. I mean, you can't. That makes no sense to me. I think it's closer to home. I think the commitment from local voters to trust that those would be there for you to be able to do that. And certainly in this case of reauthorizing it, I do support that because we have a mechanism in place. If the citizens don't like that, they'll vote you out the next time. That's the way it works. But forcing these situations is an unfair advantage of elected leaders who are in responsibility, who know the budget, who are there and elected to make those hard decisions, and then force it back into what we know ends up being a lot of outside money and starts to distort what's really there. It divides communities. It's incredibly hard. I think it's just a much better situation to put you in the same position as all the rest of us. When I cast a vote on taxation, they have the ability to throw me out or to not vote for me. Asking and taking that power from you makes it very difficult to provide consistency, budgeting, and an honesty in what needs to be done in your district.
Thank you. The Minnesota Department of Education recently announced that 123 schools were awarded a school safety grant as a result of the $25 million that was included in the bonding bill that was approved last session. The department noted that 1,187 applications totaling $255.5 million were received, more than 10 times the funding available. What proposals would you offer to ensure safe and secure learning environments for all of our students and staff?
Yeah, this is and those statistics are really interesting because you really could get, I think if you ask this question, you may get the chance to do that in political ideology on this is, one would say, when I hear those statistics, I would say there's a huge unfunded need out there that we need to attack. And then you might hear another side of things that said, well, schools will always ask for more money than that type of thing. The obvious answer to this is that there is issues in this. You've identified them. We have a situation in school safety that is paramount to all of us. I dropped my sixth grader off at school and am concerned on their safety and trust the people who are there to make those decisions to keep them safe, even in a time before we saw gun violence. So if it's that situation, and I think we do need to have that honest conversation, we need to do things that keep us safer. We need to do some common sense things like background checks, red flag laws. We can do that. I reject this notion, though, that we need to harden and bunkerize our schools. We need to take smart procedures, and we've done that over the years, that we have one entry point, we have someone sitting there. But this is a learning environment. This is one that we need to take, and once again, societal ills being passed into the school. I want to be on record absolutely clearly, arming teachers is a horrible idea. It's not one that needs to be foisted upon folks. And this needs on safety. And I think it extends in some cases when those grants, and I think we will look at each and every one of those in detail. We have aging facilities that are just not safe in some cases, and doing the best you can outside of gun violence, that we just need to make sure that they are functional buildings and that they add to that learning environment. So my take on that is that we have a massive backlog of needs here, that there, again, are good ideas coming out because these grants were put in. We should look to each in those communities to how you're going to implement this safety, but once again, not expect that an issue as big as gun violence or societal violence is, again, totally your responsibility, both monetarily and for fixes once they walk through that door, because the problem started long before the walking through the door.
Thank you. Minnesota offers an array of early childhood and pre-K programs. What is your vision for early childhood and pre-K programming for Minnesota's youngest learners?
Again, the research is clear. We know that, that pipeline to Stillwater starts way before they even get to kindergarten. I certainly applaud Governor Dayton's on all-day kindergarten. I think universal pre-K, Peggy and I certainly are supporters of that. We support community efforts to make this happen. It's going to take things like increasing the child care tax credit to make sure that families and raise that cap a little bit. This issue, and many of you know this, when you go out, and I've had the privilege to travel to all corners of the state, I've talked to people in their businesses, in their homes, and when I talk to folks, the issues that come up, and they're the usual suspects that you might see, healthcare and education, but always right near the top, two, three of those is childcare. Access to childcare, distance to childcare, quality of childcare, how do we get it? And all of us here who are parents know that that is a really big decision. It seems like it's the first really big decision. I remember the first time going and interviewing and getting ready to drop off my daughter. It was terrifying. Terrifying to wonder what that was going to be like. Terrifying and hopeful they were going to take her and that she didn't do something, you know, out of the ordinary. So they said, we have no room. We think, and you're just, and she left and was like, perfect. I'm like, oh, thank God. And, you know, Roxanne's going to take her. And so that piece of it, that what we need to make sure that we're helping assist those families, that we're helping businesses assist. I've seen things that I think, especially with early childhood care and early pre-K and some of the things that we can do, there's some really successful programs up on-site. I mean, I would love to have worked in an industry where I could drop my child off downstairs, go to my job, and go have lunch with them. And we see the results of that, and the research is showing really great advancements. And if there's ways the state that can help incentivize businesses to do that, incentivize, and we again have to have this conversation. And I know this is a tough one. And all of us in here know, when we talked all-day kindergarten and universal pre-K, a lot of providers came to me and said, because of the mandates and because of the number of infants I could have, when you pull the four-year-olds out of our facility, the business model doesn't work. We can't make that happen. And I've heard that from people across the state. And it challenges me, and I think it challenges all of us, to think of a model that reimbursement rate, that help, or making parents be able to afford it. Because, again, it's an economic issue for us if we don't get that right. They're not going to be able to work or to be able to contribute. So,
thank you. Minnesota is facing a growing shortage of teachers, especially teachers of color and teachers in certain subject areas. What actions do you propose to address the teacher shortage, and specifically to increase the pool of teachers of color?
Yes. First of all, the one thing that you can be sure of, and we'll talk about incentives and ways that we do that, but the first thing you can do from this office, and it doesn't cost anything, is to lift up this profession every day, to tell people and send a message across. And we're already seeing this, the influx of teachers from Wisconsin and from Iowa. This is a place you want to teach. This is a place where we'll lift you up. This is a place where there'll be joy in teaching. And this is a place we'll have an honest conversation. None of us who went into education expected to get wealthy, but we did not take an oath of poverty, and we fully expected to be able to pay our bills and live a middle-class lifestyle. So having a conversation that to recruit and retain the best quality teachers is a conversation on compensation. It's a conversation on about how they're viewed. And we know that that's an important piece of it. We also know that we need to do incentives. As I said again, we need to make sure that those teachers, again, when I was When I was that first year fourth grade teacher at Pine Ridge, I was the wrong person to do that job. They needed, and the reason that it was, I had it, is no one else was qualified to do it, and no one else applied. It's important that making sure we have culturally competent teachers in front of them. It's important that we use incentives, and we are willing, and Peggy and I talked about this, to make sure that in high-need schools and teachers of color, that we're doing things on student loan forgiveness, making sure that we're incentivizing your capacity to be able to get those teachers into that class. Classroom. And then I think, again, most of these things of seeing the world in pieces and easy fixes on this, I hear from rural school districts, and there was a case down in Fairmont a couple years ago, they had an elementary position open, and they only got two applicants. And when they went back and asked some people why they pulled out their application or why they didn't go forward, because it's a really great school district, was because there was no housing. There was no place to live, and it was too far to go, and they weren't going to do the commute thing or whatever. So this issue of housing for teachers, affordable housing, of making sure that we're recruiting and retaining, we're not burdening with student loan debt, and we're making sure that we are very deliberate in going out in searching and incentivizing for those teachers that are culturally competent, that are culturally reflective of those schools that they are teaching in, and make sure that we're giving those districts the opportunity to be able to go out and hire the best teachers.
Thank you. Thousands of Minnesota students and families are choosing to opt out of one or more of the high school MCA exams because they do not feel that the tests are meaningful. Yet, school districts are held accountable for these test results. The state of Minnesota opted not to, currently in Minnesota state law, that is, it is not really basically feasible to move like some of the states are, which is moving to a suite of tests to assess for accountability, meaning a student, instead of taking the MCAs, could maybe opt for a college entrance exam, a military exam, or like an ACCUPLACER. So our question to you is, do you support reforming the state assessment system and flexibility to allow students to take assessments that will more accurately measure college and career readiness?
Yes, this is where I should have my wife with me, I guess, the expert in this. Yes, and I have, as a career educator, as someone who worked alongside my wife as we worked on our master's and our doctorates looking at assessment, we understand that we need to be able to use assessments to inform instruction. And if we're doing it right, it should be ongoing and almost spontaneous and simultaneously in that classroom of that constant feedback, give and take of where we're going. The high-tech nature and the trying to get the one-size-fits-all, we're not afraid of, and I want to be very clear, we're not afraid of assessing where we're at. We're not afraid of seeing where we have room for improvement. I think the science behind testing, we need to make sure we're using it, if it can help inform instruction, if it can help show us where our deficiencies are. But this piece of this, and we know this, is the opting out and still being held accountable for it has incredible impacts, especially when we know that the locals' papers are waiting to see what those did, and then they want to put them in the paper, and then they want to show and measure us by one story on that test that came out in the paper that our math scores dropped, not taking in all the variables. It's a different set of kids that took the test. It's a different year. It's a different test. So my answer is that, yes, we need to continue to look to the science, to look to what's there, but to make sure that again, the purpose of those assessments are to ensure that we're getting the best opportunities for those individual students to learn, and that it needs to be tailored to the differences that come with those students. So, yes, certainly.
Thank you. That was my final question. So if you wouldn't mind, so I want to, first of all, thank you for being here, and thank you for answering the questions. And if you would like to make a brief closing remark, that would be right now.
Sure. Well, thank you all. Thanks for taking the time. I would say, of being on the other side, and I've told some of you this, whether it's the superintendents or whether it's this organization, raising your voice and lobbying your elected officials is not a pejorative. It's an absolute requirement of democracy. Informing folks from your perspective and lifetimes of experience that are here has been critical for me. Should I be given the privilege, and Peggy and I, to be governor and lieutenant governor of Minnesota, again, our job is to bring the public in and to bring the public will behind this. Minnesota is a state that understands the foundational strength of this state is our people. The foundational strength of our state's people is a quality education system that expands now from pre-K and I would argue prenatal all the way up to career choices. We have an opportunity here. If they're not going to lead in Washington, let's lead here. I oftentimes think of this. I hear people say, I'm really worried about the future. And as a member of Congress, I sometimes say, you should be. I work with these people. That's not the nature of us. We don't fear the future. We create the future. And it's not a cliche. You're doing important work. We're getting really important and good outcomes in many fronts, but we're honest about where we need to do more. We're honest about what it does to prepare a future. And what we're really trying to do here is have well-educated, well-prepared citizens who are able to live the life that they choose to live, who are able to build strong, resilient communities where everyone is valued, where everyone feels safe, where everyone feels they have an opportunity to pursue the dream they want to do. So this is important work. It's joyful work. It's tough work, but it doesn't certainly need to be divisive work. It doesn't need to be work where this is an issue where we grind ourselves to a halt when we're making legislative decisions. We can be informed by science. We can be informed by data. We can certainly be informed by the people who are delivering what needs to be done. And we can continue to do what we've always done in this state, educate our children as well as almost any place in the country. And so I'm grateful you'd have me here. I appreciate the work you do, and I hope you have a great rest of the conference.